Welcome to the Daily Story Brief. Today we are focused on what is really a critical moment, a moment of incredibly high-stakes diplomacy that's trying to find an endpoint to the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which has been raging now for nearly 4 years.
That's right. And for weeks, everyone's been watching this saga unfold around a highly controversial 28-point peace plan.
A plan that's been pushed and pushed very aggressively by the U.S. executive branch.
And that diplomatic pressure, it really came to a head this past weekend, November 23rd, 2025, in Geneva.
So this wasn't some big formal peace conference with everyone at the table.
No, not at all. You should think of it more like a high-level emergency meeting. It was essentially damage control.
Damage control, okay.
Yeah. You had the top American and Ukrainian officials in the room. We're talking Secretary of State Marco Rubio, U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff. And on the Ukrainian side, you had Chief of Staff Andrei Yermak and Defense Minister Rustem Umerov.
So the key players.
The absolute key players. And their mission was, frankly, to revise a draft framework that in its original form had just caused this immense international alarm. It was threatening to completely derail the whole thing before it even really got started.
So what we need to do today is really peel back the layers on this revised document. What exactly happened behind those closed doors in Geneva? And what were the points in that original draft that were so, so egregious that they absolutely had to be changed?
And then the big question, right, even with these revisions, what are the realistic chances that Moscow will accept this? And, you know, what does a durable peace even look like at this point?
The urgency here just seems off the charts.
It couldn't be overstated. You have to remember the context on the ground. Ukraine is in a really difficult military position right now. They've lost something like 450 square kilometers to Russian advances in just the last month.
Wow. In just a month.
In just 1 month. And that reality on the battlefield, well, that's what's fueling this intense pressure from the White House. They had set this very ambitious, almost arbitrary deadline of Thanksgiving, November 27th, for Ukraine to essentially sign off on the initial framework.
Which is an incredible amount of pressure to put on an ally in the middle of a war.
It's immense. So you have this combination of battlefield losses and this executive branch pressure. And that's the environment that created this mad scramble in Geneva to try and make the plan palatable, not just to Kyiv, but to a very skeptical Europe as well.
Okay, so to understand where we are, we have to go back to the beginning. Let's unpack the root of this crisis, that original 28-point blueprint. The origins of the document itself were shrouded in so much confusion, weren't they?
They were, and that set a terrible precedent. The first report suggested that this plan was worked out mostly between the U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the Russian envoy, Kirill Dmitriev.
Which immediately creates the impression that this is an American-Russian deal being decided over Ukraine's head.
Exactly. And then you had reports that top U.S. political figures were involved, Vice President J.D. Vance, maybe even Jared Kushner, alongside Secretary Rubio. It just suggested this very narrow, very political authorship within the U.S. administration.
And that lack of transparency, that lack of a unified front, it immediately led to these contradictory messages that just poisoned the well, especially on Capitol Hill.
Oh, completely. You had U.S. senators leaving briefings with Secretary Rubio and then immediately going to the press and stating that Rubio had told them the document was not an American proposal.
Right. They were calling it a Russian wish list.
A wish list, essentially saying the U.S. was just forwarding Moscow's demands to Kyiv for their consideration.
Which is a terrible look. It makes it seem like Washington is just acting as a messenger service for the Kremlin.
And that narrative gained traction immediately. It caused genuine panic among U.S. allies in Europe. It framed Washington as basically capitulating before negotiations had even begun.
But then the White House pushed back hard on that.
Almost immediately. The White House and Secretary Rubio himself very aggressively refuted those senators. Rubio took to social media, I believe, to insist that the peace proposal was, and this is a quote, authored by the U.S.
So they were claiming ownership.
They were. The official line became that this was a strong, robust framework that had strategically incorporated some initial feedback from both the Russian and Ukrainian sides just to make sure it was a viable starting point.
But that distinction is so crucial, isn't it? Was it a Russian wish list or was it a strong U.S.-authored plan? The fact that they couldn't even maintain a consistent story from day one, it just severely undermined their credibility.
It made the whole thing look like a matter of political expediency rather than a genuine, thought-out diplomatic effort.
Right. And then when you actually look at the substance of that original plan, you can kind of see why those senators reacted the way they did.
You can. When you dig into the specific concessions that were demanded of Ukraine, it's pretty clear why people initially dismissed it as being entirely slanted towards Moscow.
So let's detail those demands. We have to start with the most painful one, the one that's always the sticking point: territory. What exactly was Ukraine being asked to surrender?
The territorial concessions were, they were massive, and they went far beyond just recognizing the current battle lines.
Okay.
The plan said that Ukraine must concede all territory currently occupied by Russian forces. But here's the part that caused the real uproar.
Was that?
It explicitly included giving up parts of the Donbas region that Kyiv still actively controls.
So land they hadn't lost.
Land they hadn't lost, land they have successfully defended in some cases since 2014. We're talking about around 15% of the Donbas administrative territory.
So this wasn't just asking Ukraine to formalize its existing losses on the battlefield. This was asking for the voluntary surrender of functioning, defended Ukrainian territory.
Exactly. And it gets worse. The proposal suggested that this newly surrendered zone would become a neutral, demilitarized buffer. And crucially, it would be internationally recognized as territory belonging to the Russian Federation.
Wow. So not just a ceasefire line, a permanent legal change of borders.
A permanent legal constitutional surrender of sovereign Ukrainian land. It's not just a painful concession, it's an existential one. It would have meant rewarding Russia for its invasion and for its ongoing military advances.
That seems like an absolutely impossible starting point for any negotiation with Kyiv. It's hard to imagine them even staying in the room after hearing that.
It was a non-starter, and that was just the territory. The other points were just as difficult.
So beyond territory, what were the other major limitations that were being placed on Ukraine's future, both politically and militarily?
Well, they were clearly designed to satisfy Russia's primary long-standing geopolitical goals. Politically, the big one was NATO. Ukraine would have to agree to actually write into its constitution that it will never join NATO.
So taking away its sovereign right to choose its own alliances.
Forever. It's the key demand Russia has used for years to justify its aggression, and it was right there in the plan.
And what about militarily? The constraints there were just as concerning, weren't they? It seems like they were designed to fundamentally limit Ukraine's ability to deter any future attacks.
They were. The plan sought to cap the size of the entire Ukrainian armed forces. The number they mentioned specifically was a ceiling of 600,000 personnel.
Which sounds like a lot, but for a country of that size with that kind of threat on its border?
It's a profound limitation. And it also proposed prohibiting Ukraine from developing or even possessing any long-range missiles.
So taking away their ability to strike back at the source of an attack.
Precisely. And this is where you had people like the former U.S. Ambassador Michael McFaul calling these points egregious.
Yeah.
His question was simple. Why would the United States author a plan that structurally weakens its own partner?
Right. If Ukraine can't defend itself robustly, what's to stop Russia from just violating the ceasefire in a few years and trying again?
It gives them every incentive to do so. It bakes future instability into the deal itself.
And then there was the point that really seemed to trigger the moral outrage, the one that connected this sterile diplomatic language directly to the immense human cost of the war.
The blanket amnesty.
The blanket amnesty.
Yeah. The original draft included a blanket post-war amnesty for all parties involved in the conflict for any and all wartime actions. That single sentence, I think, caused a genuine moral crisis.
Because it suggested that all accountability for atrocities, for documented war crimes committed during the occupation, would just be erased.
Wiped clean.
Ah.
Forgiven for the sake of political expediency. The implication was that Russia's actions, including things the entire world saw in places like Bucha, would be tacitly forgiven by the international community.
And that sets the stage perfectly for the massive backlash that followed, both internationally and domestically, and the backlash that ultimately forced the U.S. and Ukraine to rush to Geneva for that meeting.
It does.
Let's start with the front lines in Ukraine. What were the immediate visceral reactions from the soldiers who were actually fighting and dying in this war?
The reaction was really defined by this painful duality. On one hand, you had profound, profound anger, and on the other, you had this deep, bone-weary resignation.
Two ends of a very painful spectrum.
Exactly. So on the defiant side, you had soldiers like a man named Yaroslav, who told reporters, the plan sucks, no one will support it. Just blunt dismissal. Another army medic, Stutzer, called it an absolutely disgraceful draft. And that reflected this real fury over the idea of surrendering territory and dignity after so much sacrifice.
But then you have the other side of that. nearly 4 years of brutal, grinding warfare. That has to introduce a different kind of calculation, doesn't it? The sheer exhaustion must make the prospect of any peace, even a bad peace, seem tempting.
It absolutely does. And this is where the resignation comes in. You had a soldier using the call sign snake, and his comment was that after everything, it's time to agree at least on something, just anything to make it stop.
An end to the fighting, at any cost.
And a staff officer named Andre really summed it up with this tone of deep fatigue. He said that despite how terrible the proposals were, if it stops the war, then it works for me. And that's the psychological leverage the Kremlin is relying on, right? That Ukrainians, however heroic and resilient they are simply too tired to keep saying no forever.
And that resignation, it must turn into something else, outright moral injury, when you bring up that amnesty provision. Especially in the places that are most scarred by the occupation.
Bucha.
We really have to understand the human reality of what a legal phrase like blanket amnesty means on the ground there.
You do, because Bucha has become this global symbol of Russian war crimes. We're talking about mass graves, execution sites, residents who survived months of brutal occupation.
And for them, that clause in the draft, the one saying, quote, all parties to the conflict will receive full amnesty for wartime actions and agree not to file claims or pursue grievances. That wasn't interpreted as reconciliation, was it?
No. It was seen as diplomatic justification for their trauma. It was seen as the world telling them that what happened to them, to their families, to their neighbors, just didn't matter in the grand scheme of things.
And we heard from leaders on the ground there who articulated this terrifying moral hazard.
They did. Father Andrei Halevin, he leads the parish at the Holy Apostle Andrew Church in Bucha, which is right next to one of the largest mass graves they discovered. Mm. And he was unequivocal. He argued that granting a blanket amnesty would be a green light that legitimizes future violence.
So his point is, if there are no consequences for this, Russia will be confident they can do it again.
Precisely. That they can bomb and execute and occupy in future conflicts without fear of reprisal. He insisted that justice isn't about revenge, it's about accountability. It's necessary for any future agreement to hold any moral weight at all.
There was that incredibly raw quote from Vera Katinenko, a woman visiting the grave of her son who was a fallen serviceman. It just so powerfully illustrates the chasm between diplomatic language and lived reality.
Her words are just devastating. She's 66, she's grieving her child, and she said, quote, they want forgiveness for all war crimes, including Bucha. That's horrifying.
You can feel a pain in that.
You can. And she goes on. Let them come here. Let Trump himself come here. Let him and his family come. See our pain, and maybe then we'll change their minds. That raw emotion that translates directly into immense political pressure on President Zelensky and his negotiators.
Of course.
They know that accepting that amnesty provision wouldn't just be a political failure. For their own people, it would be a profound moral betrayal.
And the alarm bells were ringing far beyond Ukraine's borders. They were going off in policy circles across Washington and Europe. Strategically, what was the main American concern about this initial draft?
The key concern, and it was voiced very strongly by figures like former Ambassador McFaul, was that the plan revealed a fundamental American weakness.
Brutalness. How so?
McFaul argued that capping the Ukrainian army, prohibiting long-range missiles, these things are egregious because they fundamentally weaken Ukraine. And that is exactly counter to stated U.S. interests, which are supposed to be about containing Russian expansionism.
So the U.S. policy goal should be a strong Ukraine that can deter Russia on its own.
Exactly. A strong Ukraine capable of deterring renewed aggression, not a structurally weak state that's going to require constant foreign intervention and aid just to survive.
And in Congress, U.S. lawmakers were focused on the historical precedent here. They were worried that any new guarantee from Moscow would be just as worthless as past agreements have been.
That's where you got the warning from Representative Michael McCaul. He explicitly advised Kyiv against signing anything without ironclad security guarantees. He was fearing a painful repeat of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum failure.
And we should probably remind everyone what that was.
Yes. The Budapest Memorandum was the agreement where Ukraine gave up its massive nuclear arsenal, at the time, the third largest in the world. And in exchange, they got security assurances from the US, the UK, and, crucially, from Russia, against threats to their territorial integrity.
Assurances that Russia then violated.
Twice. First in 2014 with Crimea and the Donbas, and then again with the full-scale invasion in 2022.
So for lawmakers, the core strategic question was this. If you take away Ukraine's ability to defend itself by capping its military and denying it alliances, what mechanism, what exactly replaces that deterrence capacity?
Precisely. And the general assessment was that the vague guarantees offered in that original draft, they fell well short of a NATO-style Article 5 commitment.
And an Article 5 commitment is the gold standard. An attack on one is an attack on all.
It triggers a mandatory collective defense. The draft offered something far, far softer. It was a mechanism that could be easily qualified or, you know, circumvented by member states, basically guaranteeing Ukraine would be left vulnerable the moment the ink on the ceasefire was dry.
What about the European allies? It sounds like they felt completely cut out of a process that was essentially redrawing the security map of their own continent.
That frustration was palpable, and you can argue it was justifiable. European nations were demanding meaningful input. They were deeply concerned that the plan was constructed to, quote, placate Russia without any real continental consultation.
So the U.S. was seen as going it alone.
It was. The head of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Ischinger, he noted that while an American initiative was welcome, the structure of this one seemed to just bypass core European interests entirely.
And their concerns went straight to Russia's long-term goal for the continent, didn't they?
Absolutely. Lithuania's Kęstutis Budrys put it very bluntly. He warned that any issues concerning Europe's security have to involve Europe because Russia's long-term ambition is to dismantle NATO.
That's their ultimate goal.
It is. To dismantle NATO, to push the Americans out of Europe, and to completely review the security architecture of the continent in their favor. So by negotiating these core security issues, like the cap on the Ukrainian army, the neutral buffer zones, without Europe at the table, the U.S. risked inadvertently advancing Russia's own strategic goals.
And the Czech president, Peter Pavel, drew a very powerful historical parallel that must have resonated across the entire continent.
He invoked the ghost of 1938, the Munich Agreement.
The ultimate symbol of appeasement.
A very dark moment in history where Britain and France decided the fate of Czechoslovakia without its representation, all to appease Nazi Germany. Pavel warned that excluding Ukraine from the most critical talks risks making that exact same historical mistake, sacrificing a sovereign nation's interests for what might only be a temporary peace.
And so other European leaders lined up behind that principle.
They did. Leaders across Europe, including Sweden's foreign minister, Maria Malmer Stenergard, they all united on this one core idea. Borders cannot be changed by force, and you cannot place limitations on a sovereign state's capacity to defend itself.
So with this just overwhelming chorus of strategic, moral, and political backlash, we finally arrive at the Geneva weekend talks on November 23rd. This was the moment of reckoning for this U.S.-backed plan.
It was an incredibly high-stakes weekend. The U.S. delegation, led by Rubio and Witkoff, they had to meet the Ukrainians, Yermak and Umerov, and effectively pivot the entire narrative and the substance away from that Russian wish list perception.
They had to turn it into something Ukraine could possibly sell, both at home and to its allies.
That was the job. And the official reporting that came out after those meetings was, well, it was overwhelmingly optimistic.
A very managed message, it sounds like.
It was a heavily managed message designed to signal progress and calm everyone down. Secretary Rubio called the talks very worthwhile and the most productive day in a very long time. He was expressing sincere optimism that we can get something done.
And the Ukrainians echoed that.
They did. Yermak confirmed the positive spin. He said they had made very good progress. And then the joint statement they released was designed to be as reassuring as possible. It announced the drafting of an updated and refined peace framework.
And what language did they use?
They used language specifically meant to address the earlier criticisms. They said it reflected Ukrainian national interests and promised credible and enforceable mechanisms to safeguard Ukraine's security.
That language is certainly designed to soothe a lot of European and Ukrainian anxieties. But here's the tension, right? Despite all of that optimism, they provided almost no concrete details on what was actually revised.
And that is the critical question.
Why the obfuscation?
They provided, as the report said, scant details. Rubio himself described the moment as delicate. He suggested that what was left were these difficult issues of semantics or language or matters that required higher level decisions and consultations.
Which is diplomatic speak for we're kicking the hardest problems upstairs to the presidents.
That's exactly what it sounds like. This lack of transparency, it suggests that the really fundamental issues, territory and amnesty, might not have been removed entirely. Perhaps they were just reframed or punted to a later stage of negotiation, because at the end of the day, they remain Moscow's core demands.
And all of this was happening under the shadow of that Thanksgiving deadline that President Trump had set. Did the progress in Geneva manage to diffuse that specific pressure?
Rubio definitely tried to dampen the urgency of that hard deadline. He characterized the proposal as a living, breathing document, which implies that negotiations could continue past Thursday if real substantial progress was being made.
But the underlying pressure from the White House was still there.
Oh, it was undeniable. And President Trump's own rhetoric kind of reflected these internal swings. He had previously blasted Ukraine for a lack of gratitude for U.S. efforts. But after Geneva, he hinted at significant movement on Truth Social.
What did he say?
He posted something asking, is it really possible that big progress is being made in peace talks? Something good just may be happening. Which indicates that the talks had, at the very least, stabilized enough to satisfy the White House's desire for what looks like a quick win.
Okay, so if this revised framework is now meant to be acceptable to Ukraine, we need to focus on what their non-negotiable red lines were and whether the Geneva talks truly addressed them. Let's start back with that existential issue. Sovereignty and territory.
This is the single hardest part of the puzzle. The Ukrainian parliament speaker, Ruslan Stefanchuk, he was crystal clear on this. The absolute red line is no legal recognition of the Russian occupation of any Ukrainian territories.
And the Europeans were aligned with that.
Completely. Sweden's foreign minister said it plainly. Borders cannot be changed by force. The principle is absolute. Ukraine cannot constitutionally reward Russia for its aggression by handing over land.
But the reality on the ground is that Russia is still gaining territory. We mentioned they just seized another 450 square kilometers. The original plan demanded territory Kyiv still holds. So how could the negotiators in Geneva possibly reconcile that absolute red line on sovereignty with the military reality on the ground?
That is the deepest tension they faced. And it's probably where the semantics and higher level decisions come in. Some analysis suggests Kyiv views this choice not as peace versus war, but as a choice between fighting Russia now versus fighting Russia later.
Meaning, if they accept a bad deal now, they're just guaranteeing another war in the future.
Exactly. If the plan simply solidifies Russian gains and forces Ukraine to surrender defended land, Moscow will see it as a victory and will simply regroup for the next phase. So the Geneva talks must have dramatically revised that clause, demanding the surrender of Ukrainian-controlled Donbas territory. That had to change.
But whether the new framework achieves a full, verifiable restoration of Ukraine's 1991 borders, or if it just kicks that very difficult territorial question down the road, we still don't know.
That remains obscured by all the vague language.
Okay, let's move to the military limits. The original demand capping the army, banning long-range missiles, that was seen as basically inviting future aggression. How much leverage did Ukraine and Europe have in getting those restrictions removed?
They actually had significant leverage on this point because Europe was so unified.
Right.
The Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, he stated unequivocally that the EU would not agree to limiting the number of soldiers in the Ukrainian armed forces. For Poland, for the Baltic states, for any of Russia's neighbors, weakening Ukraine militarily is just suicidal. It just brings Russia closer to their own borders.
It's an existential threat for them, too.
It is. And for Ukraine, Stefanchuk listed no restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces as another one of their non-negotiable points. So if this revised document is truly focused on Ukrainian national interests, as the joint statement claimed, then that army cap has to be completely gone, because limiting a nation's fundamental right to self-defense is not a mechanism for a lasting peace.
And finally, on the red lines, we have the security guarantees. With NATO membership officially off the table, which is a huge concession to Russia, the guarantees that replaced it had to be truly ironclad. What specifically was missing from the original draft that needed to be added back into Geneva?
The initial guarantees were hollow because they lacked the automaticity and the credibility of collective defense. Article 5, as we said, is a commitment to treat an attack on one as an attack on all, ensuring a rapid, unified military response.
And the original plan offered what instead? Vague promises.
Vague promises of economic sanctions or political denunciations. Mechanisms that have demonstrably failed to deter Russia in the past. To be ironclad, the revised guarantees need to specify who exactly is guaranteeing Ukraine's security. What specific military resources are permanently committed to that defense? And what is the clear, immediate trigger for intervention? It has to go beyond just more sanctions.
So the goal in Geneva was to replace the forfeited protection of NATO with a guarantee so robust, so specific, that Moscow would have absolutely no doubt about the severity of the response if they ever violate the treaty.
Precisely. We know the plan offered a major political trade-off. In exchange for Ukraine enshrining the ban on NATO membership in its constitution, Russia would formally acknowledge Ukraine's right to join the European Union.
A trade-off between military security and economic integration.
Yes. And while EU membership is politically and economically very desirable for Ukraine, the core strategic danger is forfeiting that military protection. So the revised plan needs a security structure that bridges that gap, one that ensures Russia doesn't simply lie low for a year or two before trying again, knowing that Ukraine is fundamentally restricted in its military capacity.
Let's pivot now to the complex and, frankly, quite shocking financial terms that were embedded in this original plan. This is where it seemed like American private interests were intersecting with geopolitical strategy, and it caused massive outrage in Europe.
Yes, the frozen Russian assets.
The frozen asset.
This is perhaps the most politically and legally contentious part of the entire blueprint. We're talking about roughly 200 billion euros of frozen Russian central bank assets. And most of them are held by a company called Euroclear, which is headquartered in Belgium.
So they're a European jurisdiction.
Primarily. And because of that, Europe is legally and fiscally responsible for figuring out what to do with them. It's their legal problem to solve.
And the original U.S.-backed plan had a very specific, very detailed structure for how those funds would be used for Ukraine's reconstruction.
It was a very telling structure. The plan stipulated that $100 billion of those frozen Russian assets would be immediately invested in a U.S.-led reconstruction effort for Ukraine.
U.S.-led.
U.S.-led. And here's the crucial part. The plan stated the U.S. would receive 50% of the profits generated from that investment.
50% of the profit.
50%. Europe was then expected to add its own $100 billion to the reconstruction effort. But the plan went even further. The remainder of the frozen Russian funds would be directed into a new U.S.-Russian investment vehicle.
A U.S.-Russian investment vehicle. That structure immediately raises so many red flags. Uh-huh. It sounds less like reparations for Ukraine and more like a financial reward for Russia, coupled with a massive benefit for American investors.
That was the exact perception, and it led to genuine outrage in European capitals. Germany's Friedrich Merz and others stated that the Russian assets based in Brussels cannot be paid out to the Americans. That is unthinkable.
And Donald Tusk in Poland was equally forceful?
He was. He emphasized that it cannot be the case that Europe ends up paying for Russia's actions. Critics saw the entire financial mechanism as rewarding the aggressor, normalizing Russian economic engagement, all while leaving Europe to absorb the legal and financial burden.
So the U.S. proposal was essentially trying to find a workaround for the legal hurdles Europe faces with seizing the funds outright, you know, legal precedents, the risk to the euro's status as a global reserve currency, by turning the assets into a profit-making venture for American interests.
That's the analytical nugget right there. Europe has been very hesitant to just seize the assets because of the long-term legal risks. The U.S. proposal tried to sidestep that by using the assets for profit and creating this joint U.S.-Russian investment structure. To many Europeans, it just looked like an opportunistic way to enrich private actors under the guise of peacemaking without ever really addressing the core legal ownership issues. This financial structure was a major source of political alienation that the Geneva talks absolutely had to address.
And to make matters even worse for the negotiators in Geneva, all of this external pressure on Ukraine is coming at a time when Kyiv itself is facing profound political weakness because of internal issues. We have to talk about the corruption factor.
Yes, the domestic situation in Ukraine definitely weakens President Zelensky's negotiating hand, and it absolutely fuels the Kremlin's leverage. There are some very serious corruption allegations rocking Kyiv right now.
What are the specifics?
The National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, EBU, is investigating a massive $100 million fraud scheme in the energy sector. It allegedly involves high-level officials, and Zelensky has already been forced to dismiss two ministers as a result.
And a scandal like that, it hits hard in two ways, right? Internationally, it erodes the moral authority that Zelensky has used so effectively to rally global support. And then domestically, it must create deep internal fracture and resentment.
Exactly. The moral high ground that Zelensky occupied to secure billions and billions in foreign aid, it gets undercut when these kinds of serious corruption allegations surface. And internally, you know, the exhaustion of the war is amplified by this deep sense of betrayal.
You're hearing that from the front lines.
You are. We're seeing reports of soldiers like one named Marin who have expressed outright support for fresh elections. He said the current government needs to be cleansed of corruption.
And you can be sure that Moscow is a very keen observer of this internal political weakness. They know exactly how to use it
Absolutely. Expert analysis suggests the Kremlin actively leverages these domestic fractures. They push the narrative that Ukraine is losing militarily and that Zelensky's government is untrustworthy because of corruption. It reinforces their argument that now is the optimal time to push for maximum concessions from a weakened opponent.
So now we turn to the most immediate practical question after the Geneva meeting. How did Moscow react to the creation of this updated, supposedly refined framework?
The Kremlin has maintained a very calculated, very non-committal distance. Now, President Putin did welcome the original version of the plan, calling it a basis for a potential deal.
But after the revisions in Geneva?
After Geneva, the Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, he stated publicly that they have not yet received the updated framework that was agreed upon by the U.S. and Ukraine.
So they're effectively stalling. They're claiming they can't comment on changes they haven't officially seen, which allows them to maintain their strategic ambiguity.
Precisely. Peskov emphasized they would not comment on changes that were just being reported in the media. And maybe the most telling signal was the statement that there are currently no plans for meeting of Russian and U.S. delegations this week.
So no rush on their part?
No rush at all. This delay tactic suggests that even if Washington and Kyiv feel they've reached a new consensus, Moscow wants to maintain the perception that they are the party with all the leverage here.
Which brings us to the core strategic puzzle. Why would Putin compromise now if he believes he holds the military advantage on the battlefield?
That's the consensus analysis. Russia is assessed as being largely impervious to Western-imposed and battlefield costs. Putin believes he can absorb those losses and win a war of attrition. The fact that Russia continues to gain territory, you see it in the battle for places like Pokrovsk. It just reinforces his belief that time is on his side.
And his standard response to calls for peace has often been to escalate militarily.
He often does, to demonstrate resolve. So the question is, what's the actual carrot the U.S. is offering? If Putin feels he can seize the territory he wants militarily, why bother with this diplomatic plan at all?
And what's the answer to that?
This is the key leverage point the U.S. administration is banking on. Putin reportedly needs U.S. involvement to achieve his broader strategic objectives. These are political and economic, not just territorial. He can probably seize the rest of the Donbas without Washington's approval.
But he can't get sanctions relief.
He can't get comprehensive sanctions relief. He can't get access back to key global markets, the removal of financial restrictions, or a say in the future European security architecture. All of that requires U.S. engagement and buy-in. The U.S. is leveraging its dominant position in the global economic and security framework to try and draw Moscow to the table.
So in the immediate future, we see the U.S. trying to push for a rapid end to the fighting, tying a lot of political capital to this outcome.
The political impetus is immense. Secretary Rubio explicitly acknowledged that, obviously, the Russians get a vote here on the final product. That's him admitting that the U.S.-Ukrainian consensus in Geneva is just the first hurdle.
And there's talk of a White House visit for Zelensky.
There is. Yeah. High-level talk of a potential visit this week, but it's conditional. If significant progress is made on finalizing this framework, it just demonstrates the administration's desire to secure a very visible diplomatic breakthrough and to secure it quickly.
But the critical assessment from most observers remains the same. This plan, even the revised one, is just the start of negotiations. It's not the final word.
Absolutely not. The final deal has to evolve into a framework that makes it genuinely unpleasant for Putin to continue his war of aggression. If the deal ends up rewarding the aggressor through formal territory, through financial gains, through amnesty, it inherently plants the seeds for future instability.
So the job in Geneva was to revise the plan to a point where it no longer looked like it was revealing American weakness or rewarding Russian aggression.
That was the goal. But whether that compromise is something Moscow will ultimately accept, especially given the current military situation on the ground, that is the great unknown.
And this takes us right back to the profound moral and strategic compromises that are at the heart of this entire effort. The fundamental tension here is just so clear. Peace is universally desired, but if the deal sacrifices core principles and rewards the aggressor, it risks a far greater instability and violence down the line.
Right. If this revised document ultimately forces Ukraine into painful concessions, giving up land, capping its army, accepting amnesty for war crimes, it risks being seen not as peace, but as surrender disguised as diplomacy. The lessons of history are brutal on this point. Russia only stops when it is stopped, not when it is appeased. Any deal has to avoid creating a power imbalance that just incentivizes a renewed conflict, which means the revised plan must be fundamentally rooted in ensuring Ukrainian strength and its own deterrence capacity.
And this brings us to our final thought for you, the listener. Today, if Ukraine is forced to forfeit its long-held aspiration of NATO membership, and if the original plan included such severe restrictions on its military, we really have to ask, what does a truly ironclad security guarantee for Ukraine look like in practical, real-world terms? Given Russia's track record of violating prior treaties like the Budapest Memorandum, could a deal built on political expediency ever truly silence a nearly four-year war?
It's the essential question. A durable peace requires institutional and military commitments that are immediate and non-negotiable. An ironclad guarantee can't rely on vague political support or the threat of more sanctions down the road. It has to be concrete. Maybe that means a specified number of allied troops permanently stationed on sovereign Ukrainian soil, or a commitment to an immediate, overwhelming air defense response within hours of any border breach without the kind of political qualifications that allow decision makers to hesitate. The true measure of the success in Geneva won't be in the optimistic language of the joint statement. It will be in the specific, detailed deterrence mechanisms that honor the immense cost paid by the Ukrainian people and ensure lasting accountability for what's happened. That is the only foundation that can last.